But Ken, the narrative is also pretty strong. The plot follows, actually, an archaeologist named, implausibly, Wayne Stickles. So straight out of Dickens, isn't it? And I don't want to ruin this rock opera, Ken, but at this point I think it would be good to pause for a little bit of what film theater guys like to call explication.
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Welcome back to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick in Fredericton, New Brunswick, and I'm joined, as I am, just about every fortnight by Ken Holyoke, who appears to be in his home studio in Lethbridge, Alberta. How are you, Ken?
I am in Studio 598 today, before I make trails to Toronto for the CCRA meeting tomorrow. So I think I have, Gabe, another visit to a Calgary Airport Chili's on the docket here soon.
I think it's possible. I wouldn't say it's for sure, but I think it's possible you might run into another archaeologist at the airport. And if you do, you should interview them at that Chili's.
I always hope that on these exchanges in the airport, I can find somebody that I can interview. I think that one of my first trips through the Chili's was Gabe Yanicki we ran into.
So. And the funny thing in the Calgary airport too is you have to play the game based on people's sartorial taste, whether that they're an archaeologist or a cattle rustler.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And it's all you gotta gauge the belt buckle size.
Yeah.
And evaluate whether or not the cowboy hat is ironic or unironic.
And what's in the poster too?
Yes. Exactly.
Yes. Another key question, and what the branding iron really means. But well, that's very exciting, Ken. So you're going to the CCRA. But let me tell you something else that's exciting, Ken. And that is that I think the fact that you're just going to the CCRA, that's like a big national thing. That's not just about the New Brunswick region.
That's correct. That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Sort of definitionally, it's about a nation.
It is.
Yeah. And so, Ken, I realize
cultural resources for the nation.
Yes, exactly. That's a sensitive topic right now. I know. But so, Ken, one of the things that we've thought about, and in particular, Ken, I think at the moment we've been trying to maybe embrace the possibility that there may be people who are looking to buy Canadian on their podcasts.
I think so.
Yeah, and I think we want...
In fact, we've actually recently started buying Canadian for all of our stickers. They are designed and produced in Canada.
Oh, that's right. And they look pretty good. We've got two kinds. One is the Gold Lame, and then one is the Episode 50. Am I right?
That's right.
That's good. Yeah, but so, Ken, one of the things that I think we've found is that we would like to broaden the availability and the accessibility of this podcast. And one of the ways to do that would be to have a title that attracts a broader listenership.
And that's correct.
We recognize that our listeners and also our new listeners, I mean, I think in some ways, I mean, we talk a lot about our long-term listeners, Ken, because they're excellent. They've exquisite taste. They've stuck with us through the thick and the thin, through episode one, through episode, all of these things. But in fact, Ken, I think in many ways, being a new listener is also valuable because it shows a certain kind of moral character to realize that if you're just tuning in now, you're embracing that you were wrong for 50 episodes. But now...
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And so with the zealousness of the convert. And so we recognize that even the new listeners probably are smart and culturally savvy. Would you say that's the case, Ken?
I think so. And I think they're the type of people that would like jukebox stickers.
Absolutely.
And I think that if we put an at... in our social media post, we can get some cross promotional stuff here, Gabe.
Oh, that's fantastic! Will you try to remind me to do that when we do the gram here? And where's jukebox?
Well, you should be receiving any day now a package of those stickers.
Oh, interesting. I can't wait. That's very exciting. I still have not seen these in person, but I'm told they're very high quality.
They are, yeah.
But the other thing that's high quality, Ken, is our listener. And one of the things that we'd like is a new name for this podcast. And we would never just steal their intellectual property. We would make sure they were richly, richly rewarded for renaming this podcast. And Ken, if they did have a new name for this podcast, where would they send it?
They would send that podcast suggestion or title suggestion to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word. Archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY. newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. And the listener can't see this, and I don't think Gabe can actually see it, but the banner that we got printed for our live show is actually sitting in the entryway of my house just behind me, and will be joining me at the CCRA. And on that poster, we very helpfully spell out archaeology for the prospective attendee to whatever table I'm sitting at.
That's excellent. And because of the time situation, listener, we're looking forward to seeing you last weekend at the CCRA.
that's right. There's going to be some weird time switching over the next couple episodes because Gabe and I got confused. Actually, well, no, Gabe, not Gabe, but more me. I got confused in the interview that we just had.
So. I tend to, listener, get confused. My confusion tends to be about 1 hour, meaning that I'm just wrong about when the podcast is. When Ken gets confused, it's by the fortnight. So that's the issue.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Scale.
And whether or not we're in Zoom or Teams, I think, is another thing. That your Mac computer doesn't seem to get right very
yes,
well.
Yes, also a serious problem. But Ken, for the listener who sends in the new name for this podcast, we've got a very special cultural program. And Ken, I think one thing that's really become clear about our listeners over the last 50 some odd fortnights is that they're not only aficionados of archaeology, but of art and of high culture. So this fortnight for the prize read, we've partnered with Andrew Lloyd Webber. Are you familiar with his work, Ken?
Like the conductor?
No. You're thinking of Andrew Lloyd Webber. I said Andrew Lloyd Webber. He's an Austrian composer of musical theater. Are you familiar with Cats?
I thought that was Andrew Lloyd Webber.
No. You're thinking of Webber again. This one was about the deli at 205 East Houston Street in New York. But anyway, he's most known for a rock opera called, quote, I Have Relinquished, which you may think is a Christian rock album of the absolute worst variety. But it's actually a rock opera about the British handing over Hong Kong. A quote you, of course, will recognize is from Chris Patton's Telegraph right after all of that. And I have to say, it's a pretty good rock opera, really. They really lean into a certain Britishness. It's got a power trio. And the narrative really picks up in 1839 with the first Opium War. Anyway, Webber is a musical genius. But this rock opera, on which I flatter myself to say I served as a technical advisor, is even more imaginative. Although I should say at the outset that employs many of the finest elements of any rock opera, including a driving rhythm section, someone in drag doing a light number, and a smoke machine. But Ken, the narrative is also pretty strong. The plot follows, actually, an archaeologist named, implausibly, Wayne Stickles. So straight out of Dickens, isn't it? And I don't want to ruin this rock opera, Ken, but at this point I think it would be good to pause for a little bit of what film theater guys like to call explication. Explication, if I may. Explicate is what we call it when I explain to you and the listener what the plot is going to be all about. And so here's the scheme. And so, Ken, how familiar are you with the plot of Macbeth?
Not as probably as familiar as I should be, but at broad strokes, yes.
Yeah. Well, the listener, any listener is going to be, one of our listeners will be very familiar with this. But anyway, our boy Webber has taken the bold step of invoking the bard himself in the plot here. And I'll pause briefly to remind everyone that Shakespeare is not a type of point that appears between Orient Fishtail and Coburn Spears. Those are totally different kinds of spears.
Gotcha.
And anyway, in Weber's interpretation, this really merges the best aspects of Macbeth with some of the best aspects of archaeology. And so in Weber's interpretation, the plot follows an ambitious civil servant named Egmic Lake Utopia. And Egmic Lake Utopia has received a prophecy from a small team of dancing witches that one day he's going to run all of archaeology in this mythical land. It's a little hard to tell, frankly, amid the heavily distorted lead guitar, what the mythical land is, but it's clear that it's home to a giant pit that's ruled by a fairy named Molly Bedlam. And the voice, which is by Wayne Stickles, is actually pretty impressive. He's got a sort of Donald Sutherland twang, and we won't even get into when the third wall gets broken. And frankly, Ken, Molly Bedlam's musical numbers are pretty incredible, too. And some of that is that I think I forgot to mention the band we're going to be using for this live version, it's actually it's London, Ontario's number one bar band. They're called the Guess Whom. And this is also all a very kind of interesting thing. We've recreated the London Globe, but it's also in London, Ontario. And so naturally, We'll be picking up the flights to get the listener to the Globe to see this rock opera. And look, Ken, spoiler alert for the listener who hasn't been by a TV since the 17th century. This is all going to end badly, but it's going to end amid a flurry of guitar coming out of Marshall Stacks. And so, Ken, I'm going to leave the plot narrative there because this really is a not-to-miss performance, and it's sure to pair well with a whole cauldron of Courvoisier. And so, Ken, where would the cultured and sophisticated listeners send the new name for this podcast?
They would send that to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That is New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled archaeology, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right. And Ken, if you crack open that mailbag, what do we have in there this week, this fortnight?
Well, we actually don't have any real mail other than our contest winner, Derek, has sent his address, and so we owe him some swag.
That's right.
And I believe, I can't remember what we said was the winning prize, but Derek, we will be sure to get that in the mail to you very soon.
Again, I'm sorry to report here. Was Derek the winner? I thought Derek was. Oh, yeah, Derek was the winner. That's right. We've gotten the runner-up.
Was Derek the runner-up?
We've gotten the runner-up their prize. I'm sorry, I misspoke. Taylor was the runner-up. I think Derek was the winner.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
We'll so, check this. We're Nothing should be construed as legally binding that we utter on this podcast.
Derek, you're getting a prize of some kind. It'll probably come in a couple of different shipments. We'll make sure we get you some stickers as soon as possible. So I will probably get that in the mail here. Maybe I'll do that right away. That way I won't forget.
Yeah, there may not be a FedEx at the Chili's.
Yeah, exactly. We've got some junk mail, something about, professional digital marketer and an SEO expert. Saqib has emailed us. There's a suspicious looking Excel spreadsheet that's attached to it that I'm assuming, if I click on that, will, probably blow up this computer as well as the one that, the one in my office from last week. But no, we're good there. We actually have a new subscriber on YouTube. We've got, I was actually listening to Spotify last night, and among suggestions that came up of some things that I hadn't listened to for a while was the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast. And I was pleased to find that we have almost 30 subscribers on Spotify. Wow. And we've got a 4.9 rating on Spotify. And so for those of you who are listening on your favorite YouTube or Spotify or Apple Podcast format. Pardon me?
Or both. YouTube and...
Or both, yep.
And Apple.
If you give us a like or a rating, and even better, if you give us like a written comment, that actually helps our SEO, our search engine optimization. So actually the more people are engaging with the show, the more likely it is it's going to show up. And so you can also find us newbrunswickarchaeology.com, archaeology spelled archaeology. And you can find us on Instagram. And I believe our handle is @new_brunswick_archaeology. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
Yeah, new underscore Brunswick.
It's sort of all one word, but separated by underscores.
Yeah, it's sort of all on one word. But if I think if you look up New Brunswick Archaeology on Instagram, we'd probably be the first handle that'll come up there.
I think so.
So you can engage with us. We're also, although we're not, we don't have a New Brunswick Archaeology LinkedIn page. If you're listening and you're on LinkedIn, Gabe and I always post about the show on there with links to the latest episode.
That's right. And Ken, speaking of episodes, we've got a very exciting episode coming up.
I verified this because this is part three of our coastal erosion episode series. And so basically we're going to be talking, or well, I guess it's climate change in archaeology, isn't it? Because it's not specifically about erosion.
Yes. Yeah.
And we're speaking to Dr. Micah Rourke, who is the climate change archaeologist for the government of Northwest Territories, and some of the interesting work that he is doing there and some of what he's seeing on the ground from an Arctic perspective.
That's right. And it was an exciting episode, and I enjoyed that conversation a lot. And I guess without further ado, we'll hand this over to Mike.
All right. We are joined today by Dr. Mike O'Rourke, who is the Government of Northwest Territories climate change archaeologist. And prior to that, he was a postdoc at the Prince of Wales Northern Heritage Center. And I think you're still with the Prince of Wales Northern Heritage Center. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so his doctoral work at the University of Toronto used GIS and other technologies to consider cultural landscape vulnerability and climate change in the Western Canadian Arctic. And he's putting that work to action in the Northwest Territories now. He is the author of numerous publications, many of which deal with climate change and site vulnerability. And his work has appeared in journals such as Social Archaeology, Open Archaeology, World Archaeology, and Collaborative Anthropologies. So welcome to the show, Mike, and thanks for coming on.
Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Thank you very much for having me. I love doing outreach kind of work. The more people understand what's happening out there, the better, really. So thanks, really. I do appreciate this.
That's great. It's nice to see you, too. I don't think I've seen you since a CAA meeting. That was sometime well before the pandemic, I don't think.
I think that was 2020 virtually, and before that, yeah, maybe 2018. So it's been a while.
Yeah.
And for any listener who knows me from University of Lethbridge and the sage advice that I give to all of my students and to my current graduate students about using EndNote software, I thank one Dr. Mike O'Rourke for introducing me to this beautiful program and saving me oodles of time in all of my work since then. So
right on. So good to hear.
All kinds of outreach that Mike provides. Yeah.
Exactly. So Mike, your job title is climate change archaeologist, which is a pretty unique job title. So what do you do and what is a day in the life of a climate change archaeologist?
Yeah, I mean, all kinds of stuff, I guess. It's really each of us in the Cultural Places program has a lot of different hats that we wear. So, you know, it's pretty variable what we do from day to day. And quite frankly, I wouldn't have it any other way. So, you know, I do kind of more quotidian like land use permit reviews. So anybody who's doing stuff up in the Inuvialuit Settlement Region portion of the NWT, you know, I'll make sure that things are going accordingly and that there aren't any impacts on sites from that. But the focus really is on the Inuvialuit Settlement Region portion of the NWT, or what's commonly referred to as the Beaufort Delta region. So yeah, I mean, you know, beyond kind of the more day-to-day land use permit-y type regulatory stuff, I do engage with Inuvialuit communities quite frequently just to make sure that the sites that I think are important are the sites that they think are important, or rather that I'm addressing the sites that they're really concerned about and that I'm doing it in a way that's deemed, you know, meaningful. It's culturally relevant, culturally appropriate, socially relevant, that kind of thing.
That's great.
But the work itself, you know, a lot of my work is on coastal erosion. That was the focus of the position when it was created, really, was on coastal erosion impacts in the Inuvialuit Settlement Region. So I spend a good amount of time developing coastal erosion models or models of shoreline change in general for some of the more prominent Inuvialuit sites, just keeping an eye for impacts that are taking place out there. And as you said, you know, I'm generally a pretty heavy GIS user, so I'm engaging commonly with a lot of remote sensing data, archival air photos, satellite imagery, UAV imagery, stuff like that. Again, just keeping an eye on things and monitoring. And then whenever possible, I do try to get out into the field.
Yeah. So, you know, yeah, we were talking before we started recording that helicopters and then potentially fat bikes at some point.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. Living the dream of getting the fat bikes out on the tundra. But when I can get out there just to get the feet on the ground to see how those remote sensing models and whatnot look in reality and ground truth things. But yeah, you know, just really generating results ultimately that I can bring back to the communities. That really is the focus of the fieldwork right now is, you know, observe and report. I haven't done an excavation since I've held the position. I haven't collected artifacts even that I've seen on the beach. I've only been working on Class 1 permits. And that's because I haven't been given direction by communities to do that work. So it's really about getting results, seeing what's happening out there, and then bringing those results back to the community and saying, hey, this is what we're seeing right now. Should we do anything? And if so, what should we do?
And so what kind of things are you seeing out there? I mean, you're working in the Arctic, so I'm sure the effects of climate change are really pretty stark and pretty visible out there. And so could you tell us just a little bit about what you're seeing?
Yeah, absolutely, Gabe. Lots. Again, quite a variety. You know, we've got wildfires in the Northwest Territories, major impacts in the southern portion of the territories back in 2023. But we are seeing tundra fires now. There was one, actually, my field season was almost canceled in 2023 by the wildfires. There was one just north of Inuvik. It got within 11 kilometers of the community, and we were almost evacuated 2 days before my UAV pilot arrived, 3 days before we went into the field. That was stressful.
So what is like a tundra fire? It's like all just the shrubs burning. Is it like one of these ones that is burning underground as well as above the ground? Is that kind of how it's moving?
Because I would have thought it was a runner-up for the Juno Awards this year was the tundra fire.
But. Right. So, I guess just a little context here. I mean, when we typically think about, I'll call it Inuit Nuningaat, it's kind of the term that we use to refer to the Canadian Arctic. And within kind of the western portion of the Inuvialuit settlement region area, it's lush. Like, there is grass everywhere, vegetation, dwarf willows. We're even seeing spruce bushes now growing in the area. So the vegetation is there on the ground, and it's been there for quite a while. Again, this is all largely a result of the Mackenzie River, right? I mean, massive, massive river. Permafrost regimes are different around there. The tree line goes further north. There's a lot of differences between the east and the west. So within that context, there's a lot of fuel for fires, and that includes just the peat and the sod. So if you look at kind of, you know, overhead shots of the Inuvialuit settlement region, the mainland portion at any rate, it's just pockmarked with lake. But within that, you've got a ton of peat and a ton of sod. So when the fires start, it was actually pretty shocking seeing them burning as we were flying by them in 2023, because the land just turns to black. It just carbonizes the entire landscape. So, you know, we're seeing these fires propagating, and because fires are fought in the south, at least based on, proximity to infrastructure. Oh my gosh, we're going to lose a power plant or houses or whatever. Here, you know, there's not a lot out there on the tundra, so there's not a lot of firefighting to take place. But when it gets close to places like Inuvik, they get the water bombers out and whatnot. So yeah, tundra fires. And that even is being driven by increased storminess. So we're seeing higher temperatures, more storms. I'm taking a break from a permafrost workshop right now that the Inuvialuit Lands Administration is hosting. And somebody just mentioned yesterday they had never seen a thunderstorm until, you know, the last 20, 30 years of their life. Wow. Yeah, so these are really new, relatively speaking, new changes that we're seeing. And we're seeing, you know, lightning strikes increasing. And that has been recognized as the number one driving mechanism for wildfires in the Northwest Territories. So,
wow. And it's a pretty shallow archaeological record out there, I'm guessing, right? And so it's pretty vulnerable to being adversely affected by fire.
Yeah. So, I mean, time depth is appreciable, but actual like physical depth, you're absolutely right, Gabe. The soil formation processes here, you know, stronger than say in more easterly regions of Inuit Nuningaat, but they are definitely much slower and they're happening. So yeah, you know, we're typically looking at a couple of meters of excavation, but that's even working into, you know, these semi-subterranean sod houses or Iglerioit. They were previously excavated into that soil or into that sand or beach ridges or whatnot. So typically the remains are within, I would say the 30 centimeters of the surface if they were laying on the surface at the time. Yeah.
Wow. And what's the permafrost? You mentioned you're taking a break from a permafrost conference or permafrost meeting.
Yeah.
Tell us about that in the archaeological record. And I guess we're probably losing permafrost, and that's bad.
Yeah, for all kinds of reasons, it's bad. But archaeologically speaking, yeah, there's a couple different ways that we're looking at permafrost impacts. So one is kind of the more like regional scale, kind of slow, insidious process of just rot. So, you know, we have objects that have remained in the ground for hundreds, thousands of years. Dr. Chuck Arnold, who was the first archaeologist at Prince of Wales, had done some work up on Banks Island at a site that was slowly becoming inundated, flooding, and coastal erosion. And he recovered a 2,400-year-old child's kamek, so a leather boot, like all the lashing and everything still intact. So we have amazing levels of preservation in the Northwest Territories by virtue of the presence of permafrost. And as that active layer, kind of that top surface layer that melts and refreezes on an annual basis, gets deeper and deeper as things warm up, more and more of that archaeological record is being exposed to things like bacteria, water, oxygen, and they just rot right in place. So that's kind of a more like a chemical, slow, insidious, but wide regional process that's acting. The other is we're looking at these things that are called retrogressive thaw slumps. So imagine, if you will, you know, you've got ground that, you know, say the top 20 to 30 centimeters is sod, and underneath that you have really ice-rich soil. Even sometimes you have massive ice lenses, like just straight up frozen water in the ground. So when that gets exposed at, say, a river cut or through coastal erosion, that exposed ice immediately starts to melt back. And of course, this is happening in the summertime. So, you know, when the river or the ocean isn't frozen. So when that ice gets exposed and it starts to melt, huge scars just open up on the landscape. And you can lose like literally football fields worth of terrain in a single warm season.
Yeah, like I remember, I don't know if it was your presentation or Max's, but showing like essentially you guys were working on a site and like a whole shelf, like tens of meters, had slumped like within a year basically, and it was just that it had been a particularly warm summer or something, and like it just sloughed off basically, eh?
Yeah. That was I think probably the village of Chenerark. So there was an entire village that was identified or documented at least in the 1980s. And when we went to look for it to assess its condition, like all we found were these giant retrogressive thaw slump scars. So yeah, I mean, wow. Devastating.
So some of your work been with, like we mentioned, Max Friesen, who's at the University of Toronto. You guys have done, you've talked about peat. You've also done extensive work on coastal erosion in the eastern and western Arctic. So what is coastal erosion looking like in these areas? It sounds like kind of the same thing, eh?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty bad in the Inuvialuit settlement region in particular, and there's a couple reasons for that. One, just the very nature of the landscape. I mean, I have never seen bedrock in the time that I've been working in the area. So it's all unconsolidated sediments. You know, we've got colluvium, alluvium, glacial outwash. You know, it's a glacial geomorphologist's dream. It really is one of the hotbeds for glacial geomorphology in the world.
Get it while it lasts, though, is the issue, right? Is that the...
Exactly, yeah. I mean, the landscape is going away pretty quickly because it's so susceptible to removal. It's you know, ice-bound sediments. It's sand and silt, and occasionally you'll see some pebbles and cobbles. So it's really susceptible to erosion to begin with. But the vast majority of the Inuvialuit sediment region is also subsiding. So, you know, looking at the factors of relative sea level change, a lot of the ISR is actually sinking much faster than the rest of Inuit Nuningaat or other regions within Canada in general as a result of isostatic rebound, or the opposite of isostatic rebound. Actually, there wasn't a lot of glacial cover in this area. So as everything else kind of in the eastern Inuit Nuningaat is rising up, you know, the areas in the Inuvialuit Southern region are sinking. And that, of course, is then exacerbating the already alarming rates of relative sea level change. So
you're really at kind of perfect storm of just bad features for preservation. And it sounds like, so am I right that it sounded like the melting ice is actually also making places more fragile to coastal erosion as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's all kinds of stuff. I mean, even, you know, we're looking at, normally you would think erosion is the big factor, but there's even sites that we're monitoring for beach formation in the front of. So, you know, typically we have these really strong northwesterly winds. Whenever storms come in from the northwest in Tuktoyaktuk, people know, you know, batten down the hatches. So when you have beaches forming to the northwest of sites, or, you know, sediments accumulating in the front of those sites, those winds drive the dunes across the site. So now you're choking out the vegetation. Vegetation has the benefit of keeping that permafrost stable, or it has a kind of a stabilizing effect on permafrost. So that vegetation chokes out, and then the permafrost goes, and then everything's more susceptible to wind erosion and wave erosion. And you said, Gabe, it's just kind of a perfect storm.
Yeah. So even when a beach forms, which sort of prevents the coastal erosion, it is having a knock-on effect. Like beaches forming, is that becoming more prominent? Like, are these northwesterly storms becoming more intensive, or is this just like, that's a natural process, but because it's scaffolded on all of these other changes and this warming climate, it's like something that probably wasn't a huge issue before, but now is like exacerbating other issues?
Yeah, I think the process of the dune formation and kind of beach threats, if you will, have been going on for quite a while. There's one site in particular, not too far from Tuktoyaktuk, where we have really, I mean, an abundance of on-the-land graves, but only one or two house remains. So, I mean, you don't have a massive graveyard behind a very small village. Chances are the village where the houses are all out near the coastline, the graves are further back inland. So chances are where we're seeing these dunes stretching now across that site, there used to be a ton of other houses, almost guaranteed, which have already been impacted by that slow, you know, the trudging of the dune sands inland and the increased erosion as a result. But it is definitely happening more now. Even thinking about storminess, you know, there was a storm back in Tuktoyaktuk in, I think, September. The winds only got up to 60 kilometers an hour, but there was a 2.5 meter storm surge as a result of that wind. So, yeah, I mean, the baseball field was full
Arctic
of water.
Tsunami.
Like, absolutely. No, it was incredible. And the mayor of Tuk actually said, like, we did not anticipate this. This was not what we were expecting from a 60 kilometer an hour wind. And if it got up to 80 or 100, like, what would have happened? What would we be looking at today as a result? So, things are, I mean, I don't know necessarily that the dune situation is getting worse, but I think in general, we're seeing more and more intensive storm impacts, which of course drives those landscape changes.
So now that the listener has a sense of what's happening to the archaeological record, they're
The listener may want to pause here and get a stiff drink for that.
They're probably faced with a bit of a sense of horror, but you're also involved in some community-based initiatives with the Inuvialuit to monitor and prioritize culturally significant locations in Northwest Territories, and work that, like you've talked about, that's really important and I think is actually very unique in Canada and in like archaeology in general. So could you describe some of those initiatives and how that work takes place and how those projects kind of came to be, basically?
Yeah, thanks for that, Ken. So I guess kind of the way I like to describe it is, as the GNWT climate change archaeologist, I may have some level of legislated authority to carry out this work. But Inuvialuit descendant communities who, you know, really identify with and draw meaning from those remains hold the moral authority. So, you know, for me to do this work properly, to have a meaningful approach to climate change mitigation work, I have to engage with that moral authority. And the only way I can do that is by establishing relationships of trust. So really, I mean, the first 3 years of this position, like I said, I haven't excavated, I haven't collected artifacts. All of my operations budget has gone to going out and getting some really kind of preliminary results from the ground and meeting with community members. So really, I mean, you know, getting into the community, having those conversations and trying to understand better what their concerns are, what their priorities are. That's how I, and again, like as a public servant, right? Like that's the core of my job is to do right by the public. So it really does behoove me to have those relationships in place. And I think so far we've made pretty good inroads. You know, I'm working pretty closely with the Tuktoyaktuk Hunters and Trappers Committee. I've been meeting with the Community Corporation. I've been liaising with the Inuvialuit Lands Administration and other agencies and governance agencies within the Inuvialuit system. So I think we're getting to a point now where people understand what we can do in terms of monitoring and mitigating sites. And that's exciting because now I'm actually starting to get feedback around, you know, there was one site, it's one of the last sites for bowhead whale hunting out on the Tuktoyaktuk Peninsula. And when I was discussing this with community members, one of the people came forward and said, you know, my grandfather was the last person to hunt, the last known Inuvialuit to hunt bowheads.
Oh, wow.
And that site really resonated with him. He said, you know, I've never been there, but like, I really want to see what's going on there. And I'm concerned about the losses that are taking place there. So, you know, to have that kind of feedback, I think that's a good sign, right? That means we're getting to a place now where I think we can start talking about what kinds of work takes place. But, you know, it's slow. It has to be slow, necessarily has to be slow, which is kind of, you know, heartbreaking. So yeah, I mean, you know, having that kind of community feedback really, I think it's a good sign that we're on the right track, that, you know, our efforts at outreach are getting traction and that people do understand that, you know, the GNWT isn't there to take away their ancestors. We're not there to damage these sites. And we're there to work with communities on addressing their needs. Again, getting at that whole notion of the public servant.
That's great. And so that's a really compelling story about the bowhead whale hunter. And so I know, recognizing that it's early days and you're doing things with the community, are there particular themes that are emerging in what sort of sites the community wants to prioritize? Or is it varied, or is it still something that that you're very much figuring out?
Pretty varied in terms of site types. I mean, a lot of people will comment about sites that they're aware of in the areas where they typically spend time. So, you know, whether that's a burial site or a village site, or even just finding random artifacts when they're out, you know, hunting and trapping and fishing and whatnot. So I don't know that there's necessarily site types. I know that there are, you know, there's a lot of community protocols around, and these are very deep-rooted community protocols around not interfering with ancestral sites, and specifically grave sites. I mean, burials that are out on the land, these log crib graves that are out there, they're very important to community members for a wide variety of reasons. And I'm always very careful to note that, you know, I'm not here to touch human remains. It would take a very special request from a community saying, you know, we're concerned about a cemetery going before we would get involved in that. So, you know, I think graves are definitely an important site that people are concerned about. But in terms of our actual, like, archaeological interventions, I'm of the impression that that is would never be an option, realistically. Yeah. Even discussing, you know, there was a situation in Barrow where the community graveyard was eroding and people were concerned because the kids were on the beach and seeing, you know, human remains down there. So in that instance, you know, they had an internal discussion in Barrow about what to do. But I'm of the impression that, you know, anything that happens now is largely going to be around municipal graveyards, and everything else, you know, we just let it go, let nature take its course.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And so some of this also is going to have implications for just the archaeological understanding of what archaeologists can know about the Arctic. And so, and some of your work has actually been on coastal erosion between the eastern and the western Arctic. You've done some of that with Max Friesen. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what's being lost and how it just shapes understanding archaeologically some of the big questions in Arctic archaeology. Like if you sort of think about climate change is just making it hard to tackle some of the topics that archaeologists are really interested in about the Arctic, or that's particularly relevant archaeologically.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about kind of how we talk about what's being lost, we tend to focus on the stuff, right? Like we're archaeologists, we're typically involved in the material remains of the past. But working in a management framework, you know, there's so much more at stake, given the range of ways that we and everybody values those material remains. So, you know, we can talk about the loss of ancestral connectivity for Inuvialuit when these sites disappear. Timothy Darvill has talked about this existential value. So even knowing that, you know, these sites persist, they're still out there, they're on the land, they're available for people to enjoy and be around, anchoring them to a venerated past, you know, there's value in that, existential value. And we definitely do hear about, you know, quite often from the archaeological community, the loss of knowledge, right? I mean, what can we better understand about migration patterns or cultural contacts, or, you know, when did this particular cultural suite pick up the bow and arrow, or how did different technologies come about and when and whatnot? I mean, you know, these are all informational values that we're seeing impacted by these losses. So I think for me, you know, one of the big kind of more academic-y questions is, you know, how does the loss of these sites impact descendant community? And then, you know, with that understanding, what can we do, if anything, to offset or mitigate those losses and those impacts? I think it's also interesting, you know, again, from that kind of management value milieu, I'm curious to see how the threat of loss influences people's perspectives around value. Does a site become more important because, oh man, like we've got five more years before coastal erosion swallows up the whole thing? How do we value those remains knowing that there is risk or, you know, imminent threat to those sites? So yeah, I think, you know, thinking about loss in terms of beyond kind of the material loss, I think there's a lot of different questions that we can potentially approach, specifically within the management realm. But I'm sure that's Max would be able to talk quite extensively about the various, you know, the more academic-y side of things, which I mean, positively fascinating. We did put out an article together in World Archaeology about, you know, understanding interactions between Eastern and Western Inuit Nuningaat and how we can't really get at that because so much of the early record in the Inuvialuit settlement region is gone, right? We don't have a lot of those older sites.
Yeah. So that's actually kind of an interesting point. So Gabe talks in his research about how, like, the coastal archaeological record in the Maritimes is truncated, you know, some like before about 2,500 years ago, right? And so in terms of sort of like archaeological chronology, what do you get a sense of, like, what has been lost in the Arctic and what is still kind of like, like, is there patterning in the distribution of sites that suggests, you know, the more recent ones are okay, or are the more recent ones threatened because they're closer to existing shorelines and that kind of thing?
Right. Yeah. So kind of a complex response, starting in the eastern portion of the area. So Eastern Inuit Nuningaat, you know, again, mentioning that isostatic uplift, a lot of the time, not all the time, and there are people who argue against it, but you know, it has been seen that generally when you're walking from the contemporary waterline back inland, you're effectively walking backwards through time. Because as things have lifted up, you know, people tend to live closest to the water. So as things lift up, those older sites are getting further and further away from it. Whereas in the Inuvialuit settlement region, with everything subsiding, those old sites are gone. Very, very rarely, very few of the very earliest sites exist still. And even there, you know, our understanding of those cultural suites is really limited because so little has been studied. That 2,400-year-old Kamek that Dr. Chuck Arnold had excavated back in, I think it was the 80s or early 90s, is a pretty rare example for a variety of reasons. One being, we just don't know much about that cultural group, you know, it's referred to as the lagoon phase. So, you know, typically we look at, you know, contemporary Inuit ancestors, direct blood lineages lead to the Thule. But there's, of course, you know, the heritage of the Tunit or the Dorset or the Chorus or Norton, depending on which region you're working in. But there isn't even a proper name for that in this area. You know, we've got the lagoon phase of a possible precursor to Thule populations.
You thought our taxonomy was bad in the Maritimes, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's complicated for sure. Yeah. So, and again, it's complicated because we don't have a really strong understanding of those really early sites, or not many of them at any rate. You know, a lot of the coastal sites are definitely gone. What we do have, however, is kind of the sites that are further inland, you know, probably summertime, people going in, hunting caribou, getting away from the shoreline, and then going back to the coast in the winter. So we have some of those kind of, you know, early summer sites, but we're missing a lot of that early record.
That's interesting. And so some of this is challenged, I guess, too, because you work in a massive region, and I'm guessing, you know, I'm looking at you. I don't know if you're in your office or your home, but I'm not seeing, you know, a bustling room full of archaeologists behind you. And you've mentioned travel by all means, ranging from fat tire bicycle to helicopter. And so part of the challenge, I guess, that you're probably faced with is that you're working with this massive, not very densely populated region. And my hunch is that that's probably motivated one of the big themes of your work, which involves using things like drones and satellite imagery and GIS and these kinds of things to monitor erosion around archaeological sites. How does that work? Sort of, how do you do that? And how effective have you found it? And what's been some of the utility for that work in guiding work on the ground or the information you bring back to communities?
Yeah, as you say, I mean, it's a large territory. Even the fact that I'm only really focusing on the Univella settlement region, that's a huge area still. So there's over 7,000 known archaeological sites in the Northwest Territories. And given the lack of extensive survey, there's probably a lot more out there. So in our office, we have 1, 2, 3, 4 permanent staff. We're currently in between GIS people, and we are very fortunate to have a GIS intern with us who's going to be helping me out with coastal erosion modeling. Awesome. So there's not a lot of us, as you say, and that's part of the reason that we all wear so many hats in the office.
And it's really cold in the Northwest Territory.
That too. It does help keep the heat in. Yeah. Multiple hats. But yeah, we do rely quite heavily on remote sensing information, a wide range of remote sensing information, actually. So yeah, being able to work with, you know, kind of archival satellite imagery, pardon me, archival air photos and satellite imagery to create coastal erosion models in advance of fieldwork or in advance of going out and working with communities allows us to get a handle on, okay, you know, this one's looking pretty rough, this one maybe not so much. But one of the real kind of game changers, I think, for our workflow has been access to, it's a product that the NWT Center for Geomatics put together called the Tasseled Cap Long-Term Change Detection Data. So this is, it's a giant raster data set, and it's been developed from, it's using the really kind of long-term Landsat mission. So it's been going since the 1980s when the first satellite was sent up. It's pretty coarse-grained. I can't remember what the resolution is. You won't see your house in it, but it'll give you a sense, because they have such a long time duration of these imagery. What the Center for Geomatics has done is essentially written code that goes through and it takes each pixel. You georeference, you know, thousands and thousands of these satellite images, and then each pixel they assess change. They do a multivariate statistical analysis on the different spectra that are coming back, and they're able to say, take all of those results, color code them, and then put them on a map. So I can look, I can pull up a site and say, okay, you know, somebody had mentioned in the community being concerned about this site. Let's go see what's happening there. And the first thing I do is I go to the Landsat, the long-term change detection data. And if I see a big area of blue around it, that blue reflects a change from surface reflectance, like soil, to water reflectance. So you'll see more blue, you'll see more kind of like water reflection. So I'm able to use that to see things like dune sands expanding, coastlines retreating. I can see permafrost thaw slumps opening up on the landscape alongside rivers or lakes. I can't understate how important this data set has been for our process of just going through. And like you said, I mean, I've never been up to the north end of Banks Island, but I've visited the sites there using the long-term change detection data. And I've identified a number of sites that I thought, I should probably talk to the people of Sachs Harbor about these sites, and maybe we should start developing some management plans for them, and maybe we should start getting some money in place or some asks for support from Polar Continental Shelf Program to get out and actually assess those sites on the land. So, I mean, yeah, it's a cost saver. It's a time saver. I think it really gives us the tools that we need to be able to go to communities and say, these are sites that we see as possibly of concern. What do you think? And they've allowed us to develop assets that we can bring to funding agencies and say, look, this is happening. We haven't been there yet. We don't know how bad it actually is, but it's not looking great. And we'd like some money to be able to go up there and take a look kind of thing. So it's been absolutely integral for our entire workflow from, you know, monitoring to establishing field programs with communities, relying on these resources. And again, I can't say enough good things about the NWT Center for Geomatics. You know, we have staff who come out with us and do our UAV overflights so I can focus on documenting sites and stuff like that while he's doing all the overflights. It's been a really good relationship.
That's cool. Just out of curiosity for the student who might be listening, how did you learn these kind of skills? Did you have any, I'm cutting Ken off here because I know he's got a question about this, but I know we have a lot of student listeners and they might be listening and like, oh, that's really cool. Is that something you picked up on the job? Did you learn it in graduate school? I'm curious too.
So, I mean, I did 3 years of a geology degree back in the 90s before I dropped out. I am a university dropout, but... from that kind of, you know, earth sciences background, I did carry forward some interest in cartography and in GIS through my undergrad in archaeology. So I did have that, you know, really strong geography department at U of T where I was able to pick up some GIS skills. And then from there, it just kind of developed. I mean, you know, read the literature, see what people are doing. In my case, it just so happened that shortly before I started the PhD, the U.S. Geological Survey put out a software extension for the GIS software I use called the Digital Shoreline Analysis System.
Cool.
So it was this free product the USGS put together that I was able to use to model shoreline change happening in the area of interest. So it just kind of ballooned from there. And then, I mean, you know, Lit Review Deep Dive, you just start getting all kinds of great ideas when you start seeing what other people are doing and what you can do and stuff like that. So yeah, I think in terms of, you know, having a technique or a technical background, I mean, GIS is just so, so important these days.
So get the basics and so bit of both, learn in school and then learn on the job as well for the tools that are useful. That's great. Yeah.
And so you'd mentioned kind of at the start of the interview that in the process of going out to ground truth, some of this modeling you're doing at the desktop, and are you finding that like even at the kind of not super sharp resolution scale, that the core scale models are reliable, that like, you know, that they're like, you know, they're definitely saving time at the desktop, but when you're getting out in the field, it's definitely helping you guys make the right decisions. When you're getting out there, it's like, okay, this is as bad as it looked like from the desktop. And it's a good thing we came to these places.
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of driving where we should pay attention, it has definitely paid off already. In terms of the accuracy, if anything, I think the results that I'm generating or that we're using have been a little too conservative. It's actually worse in a couple of cases than we were modeling. Mm-hmm. The article I put out in Open Archaeology, that was basically a large caution about, you know, using aggregated time series to assess shoreline erosion. So we can look at, you know, 1950, I think I had 1950, 1972, and 2004 was the kind of time bands that I was using to assess rates of change. But within those time bands, I mean, the one site we went to, we had set up stakes to monitor shoreline erosion. This is with Max Friesen at the University of Toronto when I was doing my PhD. So we set up stakes at 2 meters from the shoreline, 10, 20, and 30 meters from the shoreline, just to see how things are changing. The next year we went back and I saw there was a stake that was really close to the shoreline. I thought, holy cow, like how did we not lose shoreline? But when I went up and assessed, that was the 10 meter stake. So whoa. Going from 2 meters to 10 meters, we lost about 8 meters of shoreline that year. And my models for that location showed maybe, you know, 4 to 5 meters is what we should be looking at. So that was pretty astounding. But as a result, you know, I went and I started looking, is the model wrong? You know, was the data garbage? So on and so forth. And it turned out I went and I got some offshore buoy data and some meteorological data. And there was a monster storm that year. I think it was like 120 kilometer hour winds, like crazy, crazy stuff. As a result, and the storm surge really had a major impact on that shoreline. So, you know, it can be a little too conservative sometimes, the models we're using.
Yeah. So storm severity is just a huge problem for these kind of models because you're losing stuff all at once.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But I mean, to give a general idea of areas of concern or areas where communities might want to see more work happen, I think it's a really good tool for conveying that kind of sense of urgency or need for greater attention.
For sure, yeah. It sounds like there's been all sorts of lessons in the kind of stuff you're talking about for archaeologists working in other places too. But do you are you involved with other archaeologists working on climate change initiatives? Do you have any advice sort of about what's worked well for you in trying to deal with this? Any thoughts for those other archaeologists dealing with similar problems other than learn some GIS and get a Center for Geomatics wherever you're working, listener. If you're looking to do this work, you want something like the Center for Geomatics.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, absolutely, I would say partner up. I mean, you know, funding for our work, even like just heritage work in general, is pretty slim compared to other disciplines. Funding that's available to mitigate climate change impacts within heritage is even more scant. So partner up. You know, we have to be smart about our resources. We have to say, you know, yes, we can spend $250,000 on a multi-year program to excavate a single house site or a village site, but there's also hospitals that are washing out in communities, and there's, you know, schools that need to be shored up against permafrost depletion and stuff like that. So understanding that, you know, there's finite dollars in the world and we can't ask for all of them. We have to start partnering smartly. But I think the other one, the kind of lesson or caution that I would give to other archaeologists operating today is, you know, these climate change impacts are happening now. And I think in Inuit Nuniagat, I mean, we're seeing really accelerated impacts. You know, the Arctic across circumpolar Arctic is warming at 3 to 4 times the global average. You know, it is, I don't like using the canary in the coal mine reference, but it really is kind of a herald of what is to come. So archaeologists in the South, you know, understand it's coming. It's not just happening up here. And this is your opportunity to get your ducks lined up. So, you know, understand the scale and severity that's coming. Understand that you need to engage with that moral authority. So if you haven't yet, it's probably good to start. And yeah, try to get ahead of the problem as much as you can while you still have that time. We don't want that opportunity to be lost to, you know, well, it's happening up there. We got a couple more years. Do it now. Act now. You know, William Leip had discussed maybe back in the 80s. He talked about, you know, interest in managing archaeological sites really goes through these cycles that work in tandem with global crises, whether it's the threat of nuclear devastation or environmental degradation or, you know, regional wars or whatever. People take an interest in managing sites and remains when there are existential threats in place. And I assume you guys have been watching the news of late. there's a lot of threats out there right now. So I would say, you know, partner up and start now. Get it going if you haven't already.
Buy gold, listener.
Exactly.
So I think the last question here you've kind of answered already, but what is one thing that you would like people to know about climate change and archaeology? Like a takeaway, and it sounds like it's probably like it's happening and we got to get going now. Is there anything else as well?
Yeah, kind of contrary to that, what I said previously is, you know, this isn't a super uplifting topic, right? Like there's not a lot of good climate change news these days. As somebody who has to read all the climate change news as a part of their job, you know, I can confirm that it has an impact on me. I mean, it's not always great to go into work in the morning. So I think, you know, what I want people to understand is that these losses that we're facing are inevitable. To some extent, they've been happening forever, right? It's happening faster now. But like I said, you know, there's a great deal of the archaeological record in the Inuvialuit settlement region that we just don't have access to anymore because they've been getting lost over the centuries. You know, while I'm going to do everything I can to meet Inuvialuit community needs around mitigating these losses, I think it's also important that we accept that these losses are inevitable. You know, we need to come up with protocols around loss. You know, what do we do? How do we grieve the loss of some of these sites, the loss of those, you know, valued components, whether it's emotional or spiritual or ancestral? You know, we really have to look at these existential threats. You know, come to grips with it. We have to understand that this is the way of things. Nothing lasts forever. So, you know, we can do our best and we can do, I think that's really the message is it's not so much what we do, but it's how we do it. Do your best. Work with the people who engage with, who identify with, who draw meaning from these remains and do right by them because otherwise you're just making the problem worse.
Well, thanks very much, Mike, for coming on. We really appreciate you joining us to tell us about your work and about the work that you've all got going on up in the Northwest Territories.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. This is fantastic. Really appreciate you making time for us.
No, like I said to both, thank you so much. I really do appreciate these opportunities. So,
well, Ken, I think it might be time for Hit Pieces.
I think it's time for Hit Pieces.
It's not just that the climate is warming, the papers are getting hotter too, I think. Don't you, Ken?
I think so. And
this one just tore across our desk like a tundra fire.
It did. Or you know, a storm surge from a hurricane. One of the things that the listener might pick up on is that in
the next fortnight, we will talk about the relevance of this hit piece as if we already knew it was going to happen. And so we're going to go back.
Ken makes it home from last weekend.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So this is there's going to be the TARDIS is smoking right now, like the desktop in my office and like Gabe's computer in his office as well.
We won't tell you what it's smoking to try to make sense of all this, but it is smoking.
Exactly. Yes. But our hit piece tonight is actually a hit piece that is hit pieces. And so we're looking at the whole issue of the most recent issue of the Advances in Archaeological Practice. This is an open access journal. So for those of you who are interested, in the show notes, we'll provide a link to that issue, and you're going to be able to read every article, to your heart's content. And so, this is volume 12, special issue 3, August 2024, I guess the issue is dated to the fall 2024, but the articles just came out March 4th, basically.
Yeah, my understanding is that there was some sort of snag at Cambridge Publishing more broadly. And so as a result, American Antiquity and Advances in Archaeological Practice both came out a few months late.
Really? Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know the details, but I saw some email about that. And that actually is, I'm a little bit concerned. Actually, now, Ken, I'm wondering, it says the journal is fully open access from 2025. I assume that's back. That means everything, not just.
Yes. Okay. Oh, actually, you know what? Not every, doesn't look like every article in this issue is open access. There's a couple that only say, I've got access, I think, because I've got my university login.
Me but there too, are, I think.
The bulk of them are open access, but not every single article. And so you might not see every full issue or you might not see the entire issue, but I'm guessing you will in the coming months. But either way, it's a special edited volume by David Anderson, Sarah Miller, and Geneva Wright. And I'm hoping I pronounced Geneva's name correctly. They are at David Anderson is the emeritus professor at University of Tennessee. He's been talking about climate change and archaeology for a very long time. Kind of one of these like lead figures in Southeast Pleistocene, Holocene transition.
He directs the he's involved in the Paleo-Indian Database of North America, isn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. PITBA.
Yes.
And Sarah Miller is with the Florida Public Archaeology Network at Flagler College in St. Augustine, Florida, and also associated with the University of Florida. Geneva Wright is at the University of Miami, not in Florida. She's at the University of Miami in Fort Collins, Colorado. And yes. So she, although her title suggests she's also in the Southeast, she's actually in the, what would it be considered? Is Colorado Midwest or is it West? It's probably West, right?
I think. So it's not Miami University, Ohio.
No, it's CO is Colorado, isn't it?
Yes. Interesting. Because there's also Miami University in Ohio, I believe.
So this is University of Miami.
I wonder if that's a satellite campus of the Indiana University of Pennsylvania.
Is that actually a real institution?
It got renamed a couple of years ago, but yeah, it was.
Man. Okay. So this whole issue, monitoring heritage at risk in rapidly changing coastal environments. I'm going to read sort of a short blurb in the first paragraph of the intro paper, and that is that the collection of papers focus on the nature of this destruction in coastal areas, the anthropogenic climate change, with an emphasis on how impacts to the archaeological record in these settings are being monitored and documented, how the general public is involved in these efforts, and how the resulting information and supports are being used to guide planning and mitigation responses. The bulk of the case studies in this edited volume are from Southeastern United States, a couple from the British Isles. What's really interesting about this is that they are actually presenting a bunch of different case studies about how people have been tackling these issues of climate change. And if you listen to the next Fortnite's episode, we'll discuss this with Matt Betts. And we're also going to, you will have heard our discussion with Mike O'Rourke and with Robin Wewitka and with Andrea a couple months ago. And so basically, how are people kind of tackling this? And so this whole issue is about this. And one of the things that they really drive home is that there's a focus on methods and the role that the public plays in managing erosion and engaging education with both the public and with descendant communities, with indigenous groups, for example, in the region. And it kind of focuses on three central questions. What are the threats? How are they occurring? And at what time scale? And so what pace is this erosion happening? And so—
And this focuses specifically, but I was going to say, this is a working group, we should say, too, that has pulled this together.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And so what's really interesting is that, they're talking about training, technical studies, engaging and educating the public, but it's also about communication. And one of the ways that this is being communicated is that there's this new working group that I think, Gabe, you and I are probably interested in maybe tuning into, eh?
We are, although their website just mentions Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina.
Well, really, I mean, we're peninsular, so yeah. And so they are working with the public and this North American Heritage at Risk. It's a weekly meeting, I guess, of a group. And so in terms of the articles and sort of the content of the articles in here, you've got an article by Bush, which is Research Procedures for Monitoring a Specific Class of Threatened Submerged Aircrafts. Some broad national and regional efforts at capacity building and public engagement and site monitoring. And so those are Barker and Corns, Hambley et al. And Miller et al.'s articles. Geomorphological-based predictive modeling at fine-grained spatial and temporal scales. That's Cochrane et al. And Filaromo et al. Case studies that show how to monitor rates of erosion at specific site types to guide follow-up preservation and mitigation efforts. Gaillard et al. And Kangas et al. So that's something actually I'm very interested in reading through in depth. Models for developing community-engaged engagement and policy frameworks to deal with cultural resources affected by climate change that incorporate collaboration and consultation with all parties. So that's the Barham article and the Wright and Hilton article. And then finally, a digital review documenting innovative tools that the engaged public can use to assist in managing heritage at risk. And that's the Miller article. And so I think a lot of this stuff, I think both of us are familiar with many of these kind of different techniques, but it's great to see sort of an increase in this publication and basically creating places for people to like grab this information. Like, I think it's really important the pace with which this work needs to start and to kind of get off the ground and get rolling, importantly, shouldn't require reinventing the wheel all the time. That there are kind of a set of ways that you can approach this and tools that people have already tested, we can apply right now, right? And so...
That's right. Listen, there's no need for you to come up with your own SLAM model. You can use someone else's sea level affecting marshes model.
Exactly. But I mean, it's great to be able to kind of look at this sort of edited volume as maybe an off-the-shelf solution that you tailor to local conditions rather than trying to come up with everything by yourself, right?
That's right. Yep.
Yeah.
So we highly recommend that, encourage you to check it out. And it's really quite fitting and looking forward to, it'd be nice to expand these kinds of things into the Northeast and into Canada.
Yeah, yeah, we might be so lucky as to have our own special issue of the AAP sometime in the near future.
I can't wait. Ken, I think you just did that thing where if Ken's dean is listening, what he meant is it's almost a sure thing, but he didn't say when. That's the important
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, this will be on the in-prep portion of my tenure.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Well, Ken, I think we've made it through another fortnight. I don't know where we are in time in the space-time continuum, but I know that you have just gotten back from the CCRA, and I trust it was a successful meeting.
I assume that at some point the story in the next fortnight will be whatever my flight delays were that I experienced. Actually, so funny story: the listener will realize that I haven't actually been to the conference, although you're hearing me after I've been to the conference. But it was a very good thing that I phoned my hotel to let them know that I was arriving late, because I found out that I did not actually have a hotel room booked. And the poor attendant at the Marriott Airport Hotel in Toronto was having trouble trying to find my booking. And then I was realizing I couldn't find my booking in my emails. And whatever happened when I originally booked this this room, it didn't exist in their records, and I couldn't find it. So something hadn't gone through when I originally booked the room. Luckily, I was able to secure a room, and so listener, I had a great sleep at the Marriott Airport Hotel in Toronto, assuming I made it from the airport to the hotel in a timely fashion.
And what did you have for a drink at the Chili's?
I'm going to guess I had a 15 times shaken margarita.
Excellent. All right. Well, on that happy note, listener, we'll see you next fortnight, last fortnight, fortnights in the future. Who knows?
What is time, listener?
What is time? What is time? What is time? And time is fleeting and it's destroying the archaeological record. That's what we've learned tonight. We'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon, listener. We'll be right back.